Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. On April 16, peace activist and space militarization expert Bruce Gagnon spoke in West Hartford, Connecticut. His mostly brilliant speech, which I have condensed a bit, explains the rapidly increasing militarization of the American government and American society, and the connection between this militarization and the collapse of the American economy. Last week, we heard the first two-thirds of his talk. If you missed it, you can grab it from the World Wide Web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. But even if you missed it, you can start now with part two. Here's Bruce Gagnon speaking in the social hall of St. James Church in West Hartford on why endless war is a really bad idea.
NATO has been expanding eastward into Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, right on Russia's border. Georgia and the Ukraine are next in line to become members of what is quickly becoming a global NATO military alliance. In fact, even South Korea and Japan are now being brought into, Australia are being brought into NATO as it's expanding globally. Our friends in Japan and in South Korea are begging us. I was in South Korea three times last year. U.S. is doubling its bases there, expanding the bases, expanding the military training fields, taking land from farmers, rice farmers, tangerine farmers, expanding, throwing them off their lands where they've been for hundreds of years, expanding the bases, expanding the training areas. And our friends in the peace movement, so worn out from fighting all these fights, being arrested and jailed for speaking out against the U.S. military, for calling for the reunification of the two Koreas, being arrested under national security law, thrown in jail, tried as criminals. And our friends there are begging us Americans to get our boot off their neck. Their government, a fascist government, Mumbak Lee, President Mumbak Lee, they call him MB2. One of my friends, Korean friends, said, "Bruce, do you wonder why we call President Lee MB2? I said, no, I don't understand. Why do you? He says, "Because he has a 2-megabyte brain." They call him the bulldozer. They have a lot of nicknames for the guy, and it inspired me. When I came home, I said, I've got to think of a nickname for our president. I call him the magician, because you have to watch the magician's hands. The magician gives with one hand and takes with the other. And I've learned very quickly that every time you see Mr. Obama make a particular announcement, like, I'm not going to deploy Bush's missile defense systems in Poland and the Star Wars radar in the Czech Republic. But then the other hand comes out, but I am going to deploy in Poland the PAC-3 missile. And in the Czech Republic, I'm going to deploy a smaller radar system. And just yesterday, your president announced that we're going to Mars. Did you hear about it? We're going to an asteroid in 2025, and then by the mid-2030s, we're going to Mars. I said, my God, they must have discovered gold on Mars. Because we are so poor, why else would we be going there? Our streets are falling apart. Our schools are falling apart. Teachers are being laid off like crazy. But we're going to Mars, friends. And you didn't know it, though, see, because you got to watch his other hand. Today I learned that the spaceships that we'll be using to go to Mars will be nuclear-powered spacecraft, because it takes a long time to get to Mars, and we got to cut the amount of time to 39 days. Otherwise, the astronauts' bodies will turn to jello because of space radiation. And so we need nuclear power to help us get there quicker. That's your president. Even worse than George W. Bush, because he can do things that George W. Bush did. And many of our friends tell us still that he has a secret plan. Just give him time. Well, Russia and Mr. Obama just agreed to a new nuclear treaty to get rid of nuclear weapons. 30% cut, bring them down to 1,500 each. I learned just a few days ago, though, that they actually won't be destroyed, these nuclear weapons that we get rid of. They'll only be taken off the delivery vehicles and put into warehouses. They're not actually going to be taken apart. But why do we need 1,500 still? I learned that an Air Force study team said that if you believed in deterrence, you only need 300 nuclear weapons. The United States only needs 300 nuclear weapons for full deterrence. And then why do we need 1,500 of them? But some people say, Bruce, relax, relax. Oh yeah, Obama's just getting going here. He's just getting started. He's got a secret plan. It's the follow-on that matters. He's going to get rid of more of them down the road. After he gets through this NPT review conference in May in New York City, where we have to prove that we're not the world's biggest hypocrite because we're telling Iran and North Korea not to build nuclear weapons. We help Israel. I heard Obama recently asked the question, does Israel have nuclear weapons? He wouldn't even answer the question. He didn't twist Netanyahu's arm to get him to this little summit they just had in Washington the other day either. Didn't want to embarrass him in front of the world. So, you know, they got to get through this. And then after that, then he's going to get rid of a bunch more. But you know what Russia is saying now? Russia is saying that when we went into that negotiation, we tried to make missile defense a key part of that negotiation, but the United States refused. Obama refused to discuss missile defense. And so Russia gave in at the end. They tried hard. They used the media around the world to try to, you know, talk about how they were being encircled and they were worried that they were not going to be able to get rid of all their nuclear weapons as long as the U.S. was closing in on them with NATO expansion and putting missile defense systems all around them that would take out their retaliatory capability in a U.S. first strike. But they went ahead and agreed to the treaty. But they're saying now that if the United States goes one step further with missile defense deployments surrounding Russia, that they will feel like they will have to withdraw from this treaty. And then just today, again on the train, I got an email from a friend about General O'Reilly from the Missile Defense Agency testifying before the, I believe it was the Senate, because they have to approve the treaty. And he was telling them, no, don't worry, missile defense is in good shape because this treaty helped us get rid of some of the limitations on testing that was in the previous treaty that is now going to be superseded by this new one. And so it even opens the door even further to missile defense testing and ultimately deployment by the U.S. Pentagon. Well, all of this, as you can imagine, is extremely expensive. And we don't have the money for it. We don't. And so again, we come back to that campaign that we've been running in Maine, Bring Our War Dollars Home, where we think these dots must be connected for the public so that they begin to truly understand the larger picture and how it impacts their daily life. If we just try to talk about the big picture, the empire, people are so mired in economic chaos at home, in the neighborhood, at school, you know, whatever, on the job. But if we connect those dots, then we begin to help them see what's really going on. So the peace movement needs to have a disarmament policy. It needs to have an anti-imperial articulation, and it must offer a way to create jobs to those who are fearful about the future and who are very susceptible to simplistic right-wing, even fascist ideas. We must talk about conversion of the military-industrial complex to peaceful and sustainable job creation. Converting the military-industrial complex helps to solve for climate change. It's not the only solution by far, but it's a big step in the right direction, considering the fact that the military is the biggest polluter in the world today. So instead of building weapons for endless war, why can't we build solar and wind and public transit systems all over America. Imagine the jobs created building a sustainable society. University of Massachusetts at Amherst Economics Department did a study not too long ago. It's on our website, the Global Network website, where they looked at $1 billion in military spending. And they said, yes, it's true. It's true. If you spend $1 billion on the military, it's true. You create 8,500 jobs. Yes? Okay. We admit it. But they said, you take that same $1 billion, you put it into healthcare, you create almost 13,000 jobs. Or you put it into education, you create 17,500 jobs. Or you put it into home weatherization, something we need in the Northeast very badly, you create almost 13,000 jobs per $1 billion. Or if you put it into building mass transit systems, you create almost 20,000 jobs per $1 billion. So our job is to go out and talk to the average American job-scared person and ask them a very simple question. Which would you rather have for your tax dollars? $1 billion spent, would you rather have 8,500 jobs building weapons for endless war, or would you rather have almost 20,000 jobs building public transit systems, helping to solve for climate change? It's what they call a no-brainer, right? We should be constantly asking people in our society what kind of future they want for their children and grandchildren. And if we don't provide this alternative, transformative vision, another economic model, if you will, at a time when the standard capitalist economic model is collapsing all around us, who's going to do it? The Democrats going to do it? The Democrats are totally buying into the line that military spending is a way to create jobs in their districts. Just watch them line up on their bended knees, hands extended, for any contributions they can get from the Pentagon. And increasingly, as we see states fiscally in crisis, state educational institutions, university systems, their budgets are being cut, they're turning to the Pentagon. Computer science department, engineering department, all kinds of departments within the public university systems turning to the Pentagon, getting money to do war research. So the entire culture is becoming militarized right before our very eyes. My friends in Albuquerque, New Mexico, tell me that at the University of New Mexico, a public state institution, they now have private, top secret departments at the University of New Mexico where you're not allowed to enter because it's top secret U.S. military research, working with Boeing and Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, doing this kind of stuff, locking it in. I think in the end, we have to ask ourselves, what does it mean to be a human being today? What is the job of a human being? I asked my mother, why did you name me Bruce? Bruce is a Scottish name, in case you didn't know. My mother's Italian, my father French-Canadian. Why didn't you name me Mario, Renee? Why Bruce? And she told me this story about this guy by the name of Sir Robert Bruce. He was fighting for Scotland to throw the British out of their country. And six times in a row, they were defeated. And he gave up, and he went and crawled in a cave. They said, the hell with it. You can't beat City Hall. And he's sitting there watching a spider spin a web. And the spider's trying to make this one connection. But over and over, it failed. And six times in a row, it failed. But on the seventh time, it was able to make the connection. And he then coined the phrase, if you don't at first succeed, try again. And they went off, and eventually, you know, the rest is history. Well, I think of that spider, and I think of that story, and what I say to myself is that the spider understands its job in nature. It's not like us humans. We think we're so smart, and we get ourselves all twisted up and tangled up and everything else. trying to figure out what's the meaning of life and what are we to do, and oh my God, you know, should I be making money or not? Should I, you know, we're crazy. We're crazy people. The spider knows its job, and the spider is on focus, knows its job. Well, I believe our job, we're animals. We're from the animal kingdom. Our job is to ensure survival of the future generations. Nothing more important. Not job, not status, not money, not car, not house. Nothing more important at all. Ensure survival of the human species and our relatives in the animal world and in nature. Understand our interconnectedness to life. And so I say to Sister Mary Jude June, who is on her deathbed and is praying for us. Can you believe it? Her last sharing, you know, moment. She's thinking of us. I say we should love our enemies, even the teabaggers, because some of those teabaggers might be touched by our kind heart and kind, gentle spirit sometime. Not to say we should be passive and placid. No, we should be passionate and strong and determined, but we don't have to be nasty and mean and ugly. Treat others as we would like to be treated. Honor our elders and the children. Protect our Mother Earth from harm. Forgive those who have hurt us so that we too might be given when we hurt others. I pray to the Great Spirit, asking for wisdom in my spinning work. I thank you very much for inviting me. I pray that someday the American people will live free of the colonization by the military-industrial complex. The Native Americans said that the sacred hoop, the sacred circle, was broken. The time has come for us to heal the sacred hoop in all of our lives. Thank you very much.
A standing ovation for Bruce Gagnon at the end of his rousing speech in West Hartford, Connecticut, sponsored by the West Hartford Citizens for Peace and Justice, and gently condensed and edited for radio by yours truly. The audience numbered somewhere around 75, and I was saddened to see nobody under the age of 45. Where are the kids? Maybe working five jobs, like Gagnon's neighbor in Bath, Maine. Chris Hedges, whom we heard 2 weeks ago, also lives in Maine. And the tales he tells of capitalism's destruction of America complement nicely Bruce Gagnon's points. Likewise with David Rovics, whom we'll hear shortly. A surprisingly good half-hour question and answer session followed the speech. I can broadcast only a small part of this, but I'll put a recording of the whole Q&A, along with the two installments of the show featuring Gagnon, on our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Here's David Rovics.
Was a time I'll always remember. I could never forget how reality came down around us like some Western movie set. When the dust all settled, sun shone so bright, and a great calm took over us like it was all gonna be alright. That's how it felt to be alive after the revolution. From Groton to Tacoma, on many a factory floor, the workers talked of solidarity and refused to build weapons of war. No more will we make missiles. We're gonna do something different. And for the first time, their children were proud of their parents. Somewhere in Gaza, a little boy smiled and cried. After the revolution, prison doors. mothers hug their sons. The Liberty Bell was ringing when the cops put down their guns. A million innocent people lit up in the springtime air. And Mumia and Leonard and Sarah Jane Olson took a walk in Tompkins Square. And they talked about what they do now after the revolution. Debts were all forgiven in all the neo colonies. Soldiers left their bases, went back to their families. A non-aggression treaty was signed with every sovereign state. All the terrorist groups disbanded with no empire left to hate. And they all started planting olive trees after the revolution. George Bush and Henry Kissinger were sent off to the world court. Their plans for global domination were preemptively cut short. Their weapons of mass destruction were inspected and destroyed. Battleships dismantled, never again to be deployed. And the world breathed a sigh of relief after the revolution. Solar panels were on the rooftops, trains upon the tracks. Organic food was in the markets, no GMOs upon the racks. And all the billionaires had to learn how to share. Bill Gates was told to quit his whining when he said it wasn't fair. And his mansion became a collective farm after the revolution. All the political poets couldn't think of what to say, so they all decided to live life for today. I spent a few years catching up with all my friends and lovers, sleeping till 11, home beneath the covers. And I learned how to play the accordion after the revolution.
To ask you, what's the legality of NATO and what allows NATO to keep moving to the left, you know, to the east, since after World War II they signed a deal with Russia that they're not supposed to ever move, and they're not supposed to take any of those new members from the East European countries. How is that being solved, or how Russia sees that? Or
I don't know a lot of the details of things like voting and who, you know, that whole process about, you know, how NATO is really run and controlled. I don't know much about that. But I do know the story that you alluded to, that when the Soviet Union dissolved, Gorbachev was promised by Secretary of State James Baker that NATO would not move one centimeter to the east. Gorbachev was promised that. And then Bill Clinton became president and broke that promise and began NATO expansion. And I think the lesson for all of us is that the Democrats and the Republicans work together like a tag team. Or as Jesse Ventura likes to say, that the United States government is a lot like professional wrestling. You know, they go in the ring and they snarl at each other, but then when they come out of the ring, they go out and have a beer together and have a good laugh. The Republicans and Democrats agree on two fundamental things. Number one, the economic system, capitalism, and control by the oligarchy. And number two, they agree on the U.S. empire, the military empire. And sometimes they debate around the edges, you know. You might remember when Kerry and Bush were running for president, Kerry argued that he would do a better job of killing people in the war than Bush would. He would spend $100 billion more on the military than Bush would. He would be a more effective commander-in-chief. And so this is where the two parties argue with each other and disagree. But in the end, NATO is doing what the hell it wants to. And largely, I believe, under the control of the United States. And the warmongers in the various countries that are brought into NATO as their particular representatives. There's a lot of, you know, we always think of Sweden, Norway, and Denmark as being these, you know, kind of pacifist type countries. Well, I went there on a speaking tour last year, and I came home freaked out because the peace movement there is saying, Bruce, you don't understand. Our countries are being brought into NATO like crazy because of, especially with Norway's proximity to Russia, the U.S. is doing all kinds of military things in Norway right now, so, and Sweden as well, but it's out of control. There's no doubt about it. We should be very concerned about NATO expansion. It needs to be put on our list of things we're paying attention to.
Thanks for listening to part two of Bruce Gagnon's speech in West Hartford, Connecticut. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Free weekly New World Notes email newsletter on request. You'll find my email address at the show's website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. It'll get to my non-carborundum, and let's keep trying to live each day as though the truth were true. Ciao!